This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and broadcasting and cable, filling in for Terry Gross. 40 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. He was 39. He was in Memphis to support the striking sanitation workers there as part of his Poor People's Campaign. The day before he was killed, King made his final speech in which he referred to the Good Samaritan story in the New Testament. In the story, Jesus talks about a man who was accosted by thieves on Jericho Road, a dangerous road for travelers. A Levite and a priest passing by on the other side didn't stop to help the man. The person who did was a Samaritan, a traveler from an ethnic group that was looked down upon. Here's Martin Luther King in Memphis the day before he was killed.
You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
Martin Luther King, recorded April 3, 1968. We'll hear more later about the strike that brought King to Memphis. First, we'll hear from Taylor Branch, the author of an acclaimed trilogy chronicling King's life and the civil rights movement. The first volume, Parting the Waters, won a Pulitzer Prize. When Terry spoke with Branch in 1998, after the publication of the second volume, they discussed King's frustration in early 1963 when President Kennedy refused to issue an executive order abolishing segregation. Terry asked Taylor Branch why King chose Birmingham, Alabama, as the place to wage his struggle against segregation.
Well, I think he picked Birmingham as they called it the Pretoria of the South. It was an iron and steel town in Alabama that was had many for many decades competed with Atlanta as the premier city in the South, and it was a tough town. It was very segregated, and it had in its police commissioner Bull Connor a kind of a symbol of opposition to integration, a symbol of segregation, and so they wanted to in effect take on the toughest target and say, if we can crack segregation here, we can crack it anywhere. Of course, the flip side of that is that it was the most daunting and fearful target, and many people believe that they were quixotic in the extreme to the point of suicidal to try to challenge segregation in its stronghold there in Birmingham.
They were teenagers and children on the front lines of civil disobedience in Birmingham. How did they get there?
They got there essentially by progressing down the age chain as the movement in Birmingham sent many, many people to jail and tried to marshal the conscience of the country and failed. And after, I would say, about 6 weeks of campaign there, when several thousand people had gone to jail and Dr. King had written his letter, famous letter from Birmingham jail, there was almost no national response. And the movement facing surrender, and they were actually preparing for surrender to focus on voter registration instead of these challenges to downtown segregation, they decided out of desperation and amidst ferocious debate to lower the age that they would accept demonstrators down through junior high and even into elementary school, so that when the real breakthrough occurred in Birmingham in early May 1963. They had children going to jail and being hauled off to jail and fire hosed as young as 6 and 7 and 8 years old in huge numbers.
And you say that the reason why the children were fire hosed and the dogs were police dogs were turned on them was in part because the jails were already full. So the idea was to, like, disperse them, get them out of there.
Yes, and that occurred time and time again. That the irony here was that the people who put Bull Connor and his police commanders who used the fire hoses and the dogs really saw themselves as doing something that was charitable, or at least the most humane way. They assumed that they could frighten the children away. When they heard that out of the church doors for that day's demonstrations were going to be not college students or high school students, but elementary school students and very young ones, they assumed they could frighten them away and, with the hoses and the dogs as a way of keeping them out of jail. But, of course, what they didn't reckon on was that the spirit of the movement had grown so strong by that point that when the kids were confronted with these big policemen and the dogs, they just kept right on marching, and the authorities then turned the dogs and the fire hoses loose, which made for riveting television and pictures on national television, and finally did kind of melt the heart or rivet a national audience to the point of that it was the big breakthrough in the civil rights movement, after which it was impossible for it to recede without making some gains, I don't think.
Taylor Branch, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. 2 years after King's Birmingham campaign, he went to Selma, Alabama to lead the March to Montgomery in support of the Voting Rights Act. The march was chronicled in the final volume of Branch's trilogy on Martin Luther King, At Canaan's Edge. Branch writes, quote, "Selma will engage the world's conscience, strain the embattled civil rights coalition, and embroil King in negotiations with all three branches of the government," unquote. Terry spoke with Taylor Branch again in 2006.
What was the reason for planning the march from Selma to Montgomery?
It was to win the right to vote for black people in Alabama, which was a plan that had come to King. Of course, the movement had been struggling for the right to vote from the very beginning in the 1950s in many forms, including Freedom Summer in Mississippi. But this particular plan came to King from two young people on his staff, Jim Bevel and Diane Nash, who basically stayed up all night on the night of the Birmingham church bombing in 1963, crying and wringing their hands over the death of these four children and vowing that by morning they would come up with a plan to answer it on their own as citizens. And they came up with a plan to try to paralyze the state of Alabama with a nonviolent army until it granted the right for black people to vote, and that was essentially the blueprint for the Selma movement.
And what happened on the first attempt to make that march in March of 1965?
March 7th, 1965, 600 black people from Selma and surrounding rural counties started to march 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery to present a petition to George Wallace. This is after 2 months of demonstrations in Selma. And they got across the Edmund Pettus Bridge over the Alabama River and were blocked on the other side by Alabama state troopers and mounted kind of sheriff's possemen, and who drove them back in a cloud of tear gas and truncheons and beat them across the bridge in what became known as Bloody Sunday, and caused a crisis in the in national politics, but certainly in the civil rights movement.
Now, you write that Governor Wallace and his deputies debated a suggestion to let the march go forward unmolested, and basically this was a scheme to set a mousetrap for Martin Luther King. What was the trap they were thinking of setting?
The mousetrap option was simply to bluff like they were going to block the march and then let it go through and open the highway and let them go, because Wallace's people knew that between Selma and Montgomery there was 54 miles of some of the most forbidding country for black people in America, including Lowndes County, which lay between Selma and Montgomery, where no black person had voted in the 20th century, even though they were some 70% of the county population. and that it was a county notorious for lynching and brutality, and they thought that the marchers would not be capable of marching 54 miles, and that especially if they thought they were going to be blocked, they wouldn't be provisioned. And their plan was to open the road but then not let anybody on the road to resupply them and essentially maroon them out in hostile Klan country and calculate that they would then limp back into Selma in failure. But they ultimately rejected that plan.
But on a subsequent attempt to make this march, the troops kind of cleared the way for King and the marchers to go. And King didn't know what to make of that, and he didn't know what to do. What was this about?
Well, on the night of Bloody Sunday, March 7th, King put out a nationwide call for people to come and try to march again so as violence couldn't stop the movement. And only 2 days later, they made the second attempt that you're referring to. But by then, there were hundreds and hundreds of people had come from all over America on almost no notice. So there was a whole host of people. Now it's an integrated group of several thousand people with King at its lead. And the federal government has, in the meantime, issued an injunction ordering King not to march until the federal government held a hearing and a court held a hearing over whether or not this was should be a protected activity and what the rights of the state of Alabama were and what the duties of the federal government were. And so the federal government privately interceded with King, telling him not to march. People in the movement felt they had to march. There were tremendous rivalries. People were at one another's throats about whether they should march federal government or not. And King faced very difficult decisions all night about what to do. And, of course, nobody knew what Governor Wallace was going to do, whether he was going to try to repress this march as well or not. But ultimately, he did order the troopers blocking the march when this host went forward, which was an integrated host with a lot of prominent politicians as well as clergy and students. And they opened the march, and King went across the bridge far enough to say that he had marched and a little past where they were, but then when they opened the way, he turned around and went back. And some people lost faith in King permanently, but it was about a very fundamental issue, which was what is the best political strategy for this movement to keep going and enact what became the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And King felt that by marching halfway and back, he was basically doing the best he could to preserve the momentum of his movement, but also his relationship with the federal government, which was going to have to enact this law.
So was King more afraid of what the troopers had in store for him or of the injunction from the federal government against the march?
He was afraid of losing his alliance with the federal government if the federal government had to put him in jail for the first time and say he had blocked a federal injunction. He knew it would make it almost impossible for President Johnson to introduce a voting rights bill, which was his ultimate goal, to establish the right to vote by law. President Johnson did decide to go before the well of the Congress and propose the Voting Rights Act in a historic speech, and that's the speech where he closed by saying, "We shall overcome," which was an odd, jaw-dropping moment in the well of the House. Many people thought they would never see any president, let alone a Southern president, say, adopt the slogan of the Civil Rights Movement to enact a major piece of legislation. And within a day after that, the federal judges ordered the federal government to protect the march. So after much, much drama, political drama, all of which raised the profile of this effort to march through Klan country with nonviolent, unarmed people, the march took off a third time 2 weeks after Bloody Sunday on March 21st, and a great host marched 54 miles into Montgomery, ending on March 25th when King gave the speech right under the dome of the Alabama Capitol, at the foot of the Capitol, how long, not long, about the meaning of the Voting Rights March.
Well, King and LBJ, you know, kind of agreed on civil rights. I mean, LBJ wasn't out there in the streets with Martin Luther King, but, you know, he was an advocate, finally, of civil rights. But King and LBJ were opposed when it came to the war in Vietnam. LBJ escalated the war. King opposed the war. How did it affect their relationship to disagree so strongly about Vietnam?
It destroyed their relationship, but it destroyed their relationship in a almost in a haunting and respectful way. Johnson apologized for the war to King, but I don't think that he distorted his view. Johnson wanted anything he could do to avoid the war. He hated the war. I think the record pretty clearly shows that there was no argument that an anti-war person ever made against the Vietnam War that Johnson didn't think of first and probably agree with. He knew from the beginning that stalemate was likely and that lots of bloodshed was likely to produce no satisfactory result, but he did it anyway because he said, otherwise they'll call me a coward and run me out of office. King knew that. He knew Johnson didn't want to do the war, and he also felt that Johnson's commitment to civil rights, since after all he consciously surrendered the South from the Democratic column and said, I'm giving it up for my lifetime and future ones to the Republican Party, and that he was consciously changing the partisan structure of the United States, that he was genuine about civil rights. He felt that Johnson made a terrible mistake, a tragic mistake about Vietnam, knowing that he was doing it, but King felt sympathy for Johnson to the point that he always said, I have never criticized Johnson and even used his name. He never, in all of his criticisms of Vietnam, he never said, this is President Johnson's war. He never said, Lyndon Johnson is wrong. He said, I have never called the president's name. This is our war. Our country is doing it. And I'm not going to blame it all on one poor Texas school teacher.
What was the reaction within the civil rights movement to Martin Luther King's opposition to the war in Vietnam?
The major civil rights leaders like Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins criticized Dr. King, said he should stay out of foreign policy. They were loyal to the Johnson administration. Some others felt that he didn't go far enough in criticizing the war and welcomed his criticism. The reaction that hurt Dr. King the most was the reaction of the major news organizations, the editorial boards of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Kind of the established opinion said he should stay out of foreign affairs and stick to race relations, which is what most senators and congressmen said, that he disgraced himself and that he should stay in race relations. Those opinions hurt Dr. King the most because he felt they were essentially denying his right to speak, segregating his citizenship.
Here's an excerpt of King's speech, Beyond Vietnam, which he delivered on April 4, 1967, at the Riverside Church in Manhattan. Laying out his arguments against the war in Vietnam, he said he had seven reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of his moral vision. His third came out of his experiences working in the ghettos of Chicago.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
An excerpt from King's speech Beyond Vietnam, delivered on April 4, 1967, 1 year before King's death. Terry spoke to Taylor Branch in 2006. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. 40 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis. Our next guest, Michael Honey, has written a book about the campaign on which King was working when he was killed. As Honey points out, although many people know that King died in Memphis, many don't know what he was doing there. He was joining forces with 1,300 black sanitation workers who were striking for the right to unionize. The strikers and their supporters turned Memphis upside down for 65 days in the winter of 1968. King saw his work in Memphis as part of a new direction in the civil rights movement, emphasizing economic equality. He said, quote, "We know that it isn't enough to integrate lunch counters. What does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a hamburger and a cup of coffee?" Unquote. Michael Honey's book is called Going Down Jericho Road. Honey is a professor of labor studies and American history at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He spoke with Terry Gross last year.
What was the Memphis sanitation workers' strike about, and what set off the strike?
It was about really this dignity for these workers and dignity for African Americans in a city that was still tied to the old plantation ways and thought it had solved its race problems, but really hadn't, and was very much a paternalistic, top-down, good old boy system, and Mayor Henry Loeb sort of represented that. But in terms of the strike, what set it off was just horrible working conditions.
Yeah, why don't you describe the conditions?
Well, most of these people worked as they identified them as casual laborers, and so they had no set hours. They could come in and work for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours until the job was done. They were never sure how much they were going to be paid for that work. They didn't have pensions. They didn't have vacations. They didn't have most of the things you would think you would have with a full-time job. And they were very expendable. They could be fired on a moment's notice. And on top of that, they were making poverty-level wages. 40% of those workers in the sanitation department were on welfare, even while they were working full-time jobs.
The slogan of the Memphis sanitation worker strike was, "I am a man," and "am" was underlined. What was the meaning the leadership wanted that slogan to have?
The "I am a man" slogan sort of emanated from the ranks of the workers. A lot of these workers were very religious, so they had a real conception of dignity and justice based on the Bible and their understanding of Christianity. And they wanted to be treated as human beings with respect. And it was an all-male workforce, so it was, "I am a man." But the whole black community took up this slogan. Everybody instantly recognized what this slogan meant. It meant we want an end to the plantation mentality and the disrespect that white people show to black people every day of their lives.
What did Martin Luther King see as his role in the Memphis sanitation workers' strike?
You know, I think King did in Memphis what he so famously did in so many places. You can really see why he was so important to the movement when you see what he did in Memphis. You know, there was a lot of backlash against King in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and some of the younger people in that period, because people would say, well, he'd come in, he'd make a speech, and then he'd leave. He'd get a lot of publicity, but we're still here doing the organizing. And some people resented that. But what actually transpired in Memphis was that the local movement went on for about 6 weeks, and they were really desperate to get some national media coverage. He came in, he brought the national media attention. Suddenly the national labor unions, AFL-CIO, George Meany, started to pay attention. Money started coming in to the strike to support it. And more than that, when King came in, he assessed the situation immediately and gave a brilliant speech on March 18th that just shook the place. There were 15,000 people there at this speech, and he called for a general strike in Memphis of all black workers, domestic workers, garbage workers, teachers, students, everybody. Walk out and shut the city down. And if you hear the recording of that, people just went nuts.
Well, you actually brought a copy of the recording with you, so I'd like you to play us an excerpt of it. Would you introduce the excerpt that you'd like to play?
Yeah, what's happening here is that King has flown in from Los Angeles via Jackson, Mississippi. He's on the Poor People's Campaign. He's in himself in serious trouble. He's exhausted. The FBI is pursuing him every step of the way. They're wiretapping him. They've got informants in his organization. He comes to Memphis, and instead of what he's experiencing in many places, which is a lot of backlash against him because of his anti-war stand, even in the black community, a lot of people dissing him for opposing military action in Vietnam. Instead of that, he comes to Memphis, and people are so overjoyed to see him and so happy to have him come into their movement. And he responds to that by explaining in a way that almost nobody else could do why their strike was so important and why it was so important for the middle class to support the working class and the poor in this situation.
Okay, so this is Martin Luther King recorded on March 18th, 1968.
If we are going to get equality, if we are going to get adequate wages, we are going to have to struggle for it. Now, you know what? You may have to escalate the struggle a bit. If they keep refusing and they will not recognize the union and will not agree for the checkoff of the collection of dues, I tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. Not a Negro in this city will go to any job downtown. When no Negro in domestic service will go to anybody's house, anybody's kitchen.
It's an excerpt of Martin Luther King speaking on March 18th of 1968. And Michael Honey, so after Martin Luther King calls for this general strike, then you have to figure out, you know, the leadership had to figure out, well, what shape would the general strike take, and how do you keep it nonviolent? What shape did they want the general strike to take?
Well, unfortunately, there was no follow-up to this. Taylor Rogers, who was very active in the strike and later became the president of AFSCME Local 1733, said, well, you know, we never really followed that up. It was a great idea, and they were ready to do it on a kind of spontaneous basis, and King was then scheduled to come back in a few days and lead a mass march, and undoubtedly, if he had come back to do that, the students would have walked out of the schools, a lot of people would have refused to go to work. It would have been something like a general strike of black workers, but instead what happened was they had this incredible snowfall that just froze the Mid-South. It was a freak snowfall. And so King couldn't come back. And then they had to reschedule it, and he came back quite a bit later, and things had changed, and some of the energy had dissipated. And then a lot of divisions started to sort of emerge within the movement.
Well, although the general strike never happened, there was a big demonstration that did happen on behalf of the sanitation workers. Tell us about that demonstration and how it ended up in a confrontation with the police.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that King came in from New York City, where he was working on the Poor People's Campaign, and he came in very late. The march was supposed to start at 10 o'clock, and King was nowhere to be seen, and they didn't want to start without him. This is March 28th. It's, you know, by that time, it's pretty hot in Memphis. And people were waiting around for him for an hour and a half or so. Meanwhile, students were walking out of the schools, and there was an incident at Hamilton High School where the police came in and attacked the students, beat some people up. One young woman was badly hurt, and the rumor spread that she had been killed. So all these students started coming downtown to gather for the march, and they were extremely agitated and angry. And at the same time, a lot of the street people around Beale Street, which is, you know, that famous street in Memphis of the blues and everything else, people who were pickpockets, petty thieves, not movement people at all, began to intersperse themselves into the march. And so when King finally did arrive, the march itself was sort of out of control. The marshals couldn't keep people together the way they wanted them to be. And when the march finally did start, somebody started breaking windows. And suddenly they were in a situation where King's leading a march, and behind him, windows are being broken, and it looks like a riot is about to happen.
That was a big fear that a lot of the organizers of the demonstration had, that somehow, like, younger people or other people latching onto the demonstration would become violent, and it would change the tone completely of the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, this was the thing everybody was afraid about, having to do with the Poor People's Campaign itself. King was talking about taking masses of people to Washington, D.C., and as you remember, you know, we had the long, hot summers back then. Every summer, huge riots would take place in the inner cities, usually set off by a confrontation with the police. So what happened in Memphis was that King was suddenly put in that very situation that everybody was dreading. And King, at the front of the march, was suddenly confronted with a whole mass of police with their gas masks, their clubs, which were 4 feet long, their weapons drawn. And James Lawson, the ministerial leader, took King out of the march because he didn't want King to be in the position of leading a riot, one, and two, he didn't want King himself to get killed or badly hurt by the police. So when they pulled King out, then the police attacked. And it wasn't so much a riot of the people as it was a riot of the police. And when the police attacked, then it just spread and it became a riot of everybody. But, you know, actually, as riots go, it wasn't much. There was not that much damage. It wasn't an attack against people at all. It was an attack against property. People were stealing liquor out of stores. But, you know, how big of a crime is that? What was really bad about it was that the police just laid siege to the black community for the next 3 days, and they brought in the National Guard, and suddenly Memphis became a police state.
Let's hear an excerpt of a speech that Martin Luther King gave on April 3rd of 1968, and this was the day before he was killed. How long is the speech after the confrontation that we were just talking about?
The confrontation happens on March 28th, and then the National Guard is brought in, and there's martial law for about 4 or 5 days. They have a meeting in Atlanta to try to decide what to do about Memphis, and there's a lot of division within the ranks of King's own organization. They're angry that he went to Memphis, said, you never should have gone there. We didn't want you to do this in the first place. King walks out of the meeting, goes away for several hours. Finally, the staff realizes that they have to unify behind him, and he says, I think we have to go back to Memphis or else I'm done as a leader. And so they finally agree to that, and they all come back on April 2nd, and then King comes in on April 3rd, and he's served with a federal injunction saying he cannot march. And in the past, King has always tried to not go against federal courts because the federal courts have been often on the side of the movement. So on April 3rd, he's giving this speech in the context of he's saying, I'm going to defy the federal injunction. We're going to march come hell or high water, and it's going to be a nonviolent march. So he's putting everything on the line.
And this speech is most famous for his for the end of the speech in which he talks about how he's been to the mountaintop. But the part we're going to hear is specifically about the Memphis sanitation strike and the importance of supporting these striking sanitation workers. So here's Martin Luther King.
The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now, we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the article. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering, sometimes going hungry, going through dark and dreary nights, wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. And we've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. For when people get caught up with that which is right, and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping point short of victory.
That's Martin Luther King in Memphis on the day before he was killed. And my guest, Michael Honey, is the author of the book Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. The day after the speech that we've been talking about, Martin Luther King is assassinated. Did you learn anything that you didn't already know about his assassination when you were doing research for your book?
I learned some nuances. There are FBI files on King that fill up almost a whole room at the FBI research room in Washington, D.C. I didn't go through all those files because a number of scholars have gone through them in great depth. One of the things that they did was J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, instructed his agents not to pass on information to King when there was a threat against his life. So they knew there were threats on King when he was coming into Memphis, but they're not passing them on to King. So in addition to that, I found that there were about 40 police cars in that area of Memphis circling around. The police were everywhere. Once King was shot, the police came out of the woodwork. Jesse Jackson was there, and the New York Times interviewed him and said, what happened? He said, well, there was a shot, and all these police came charging to us, but clearly the shot came from somewhere else. We could hear the rifle shot over in the distance, but none of them were going toward where the shot was heard. They were going toward the balcony. So a lot of people were drawing this conclusion that the police already knew what the target was. Now, beyond that, we know that there was a reward out on King's life and that James Earl Ray somehow escaped, despite the fact that there were police everywhere, and was on his way to Rhodesia from England, I believe it was, when he was arrested. Now, a lot of people in the black community at the time did not believe the idea that it was just one person that came in and did it. I don't know what the answer to that is, but certainly King was not getting the protection that he should have gotten under the circumstances that existed at that time.
Michael Honey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Honey, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. His book, Going Down Jericho Road, examines what causes Martin Luther King Jr. was fighting in Memphis when he was assassinated 40 years ago today. Shine a Light, the new concert film about the Rolling Stones, was shot over two performances at the Beacon Theater in New York in the fall of 2006. Director Martin Scorsese was less interested in making a standard rock concert documentary than in capturing the spirit, and especially the music, of the Rolling Stones. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The funniest thing in Martin Scorsese's mega-wattage Rolling Stones concert movie Shine a Light is footage of a young, soft-faced Jagger in the mid-60s being asked how much longer he thinks the Stones will stay together. What is it about this band that makes you always think of its demise? Is it something inherently fraught about their sound, that blend of driving rock and ramshackle blues? Is it Keith Richards' legendary drug intake, which killed many a musician who tried to keep up? Scorsese doesn't penetrate the mystery of the band's regeneration. He stands before Jagger like a pagan sun worshiper. He knows that merely capturing this magical energy, this dynamo, is triumph enough. He comes close to pulling it off, although I didn't see Shine a Light in IMAX, and I think its extra oomph might make a difference. Scorsese brings together a Marvel Comics-worthy assemblage of super cinematographers who shot their footage from all angles, and he cuts it together to get your adrenaline flowing. But Jagger is remote. His singing has always had a dash of irony. He has a persona, insinuating, more than a little black, polymorphously sexual. But here it feels rote, as if the lyrics have no connection to anything in his life now. Scorsese is canny enough to make Jagger's elusiveness the movie's launching point. The director appears in a black-and-white prologue, trying to connect over the phone with Jagger about the set, the song list, the camera.
My other worry about the cameras was, Marty, that they whiz around all the time, and it's very annoying to the audience and to everyone on the stage, and it's dangerous.
It'd be good to have a camera that moves, that swoops down and in and out,
yeah,
and tracks us, you know, along the side somehow.
Is that it?
I think so.
Okay.
Okie
dokie, guys. Nice to chat.
Jagger's motor runs too fast, even for Scorsese, king of speed-freaky motor mouths. Yet even here, in concert, Jagger is a fascinating spectacle. His lightning stutter steps, his rope-thin torso, his spastic finger-pointing. His voice has always been underrated, and it still has power.
So give me all your money. Give me all your gold. I'll buy your house by the Zuma Beach. I'll give you half. French girls, they want Cartier. Italian girls who love cars. American girls want everything in the world you could possibly imagine. English girls, they're so prissy. I can't stand them on the telephone. I just want to try the whole damn thing off. I never want them to ever call me at all.
My favorite rock concert movie is Jonathan Demme's Stop Making Sense with the Talking Heads. There, and in his Neil Young Heart of Gold, Demme shoots performance in a way that illuminates the performer's roots and the process of putting the music and the act together. Shine a Light is nowhere near that organic. Scorsese is firmly on the outside, peering in. Yet there is, amid the spectacle, a point of connection between him and the Stones. Scorsese has always adored rock. He uses it marvelously in his films and made a classic concert movie, The Last Waltz. Here, he ceded power to Jagger, who wouldn't even give him a set list. But Scorsese is a rock star in the editing room. At the end of Shine a Light, he takes the movie back. The camera follows the Stones out of the Beacon Theater, and there's Scorsese outside the stage door, waving the camera up, up, up over Manhattan Island. He's showing off his own muscle by rising above the throng.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Stolen directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. and Cooley.
I saw you stretched out in room 1009 with a smile on your face and a dream light in your eye. I could not seem to get a line on you.